Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. In particular, the Wisconsin recall vote that is likely to be seen either as an endorsement of Republican ALEC plans to break public employee unions or victory for Labor and the Democrats facing a tide of corporate and super PAC money pouring in ahead of the November elections. We'll begin with Joel Rogers, a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he directs the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. We will discuss the local dynamics of a race that has taken on national significance. Then we'll get a sense of how politics have become so intense and polarized in a state that has long been considered to be moderate and centrist. We will speak with the editor of WisPolitics.com, J.R. Ross. He has covered Wisconsin politics and the State House for the last decade. Then we get an update on the record amount of out-of-state money that has poured into this recall race. Bill Leaders, a veteran Wisconsin newspaper editor and reporter, who is the Money and Politics Project Director at WisconsinWatch.org, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with a reporter on another subject. That is, what happens when a labor journalist tries to interview the CEO of a big corporation at a hearing on Capitol Hill? Mike Elk, who writes for Harper's Magazine, The American Prospect, The Huffington Post, and is a staff writer for In These Times, joins us to tell how his microphone was ripped from him by a staffer for a Republican congressman, and how the communications director of the Honeywell Corporation locked him in a room in the Capitol to prevent him from reporting. And joining us now is Joel Rogers, who is a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs COWS, the Center for Wisconsin Strategy. Joel Rogers has written widely on American politics and public policy in such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Rogers.
Nice to be here, Ian.
And
sounds like an exciting show. God, I wish I could hear it all.
Well, let me just pick you up where your book left off, American Society, How It Really Works. Tell me about Wisconsin society, because, whether you like it or not, you become a national guinea pig.
Yeah, what do you want to know?
Well, I would like to understand what it is that has changed that. I mean, maybe it hasn't changed. I mean, this is a state that did produce Joe McCarthy, but also La Follette and other progressives. So has it suddenly become polarized, or has it always had these extremes sort of bubbling under the surface?
I think it's fair to say it's always had those extremes bubbling under the surface, or you've always had a slightly schizophrenic quality to Wisconsin politics. You've got small-scale, capital-intensive, dairy, agriculture, making an alliance with a bunch of German emigres from the revolutions of 1848 on one side, and then you've got a bunch of other people, trying to rip up some forests or, get away from cities and black people on the other. And it's always been pretty divided, I think it's fair to say.
So, but this is a lot of out-of-state money's coming to this race, so...
Yeah, huge amount.
So what's the out-of-state interest? What's the Koch brothers' interest, for example?
Well, in Skywalker, they found a I'm-willing-to-do-anything politician who would do their bidding. And he, when he first came into state politics, he, his first act was to introduce about 8 bills from ALEC and just hand them over to the Ledge Council and said, yeah, let's do this. And then he, in Milwaukee, was critical in overturning a longstanding Democratic county executive, and that was a sort of an orchestrated but populist-sounding recall election. That's how he came into office. And it was, I think, clear to money people like the Kochs and others that he was, he was a good sort of teddy boy for the Rights Project, which is, as you know, as you often talk about on the show, is basically to repeal the 20th century and get rid of the affirmative state. And in Wisconsin, that is where Wisconsin was distinctive, because we had the progressives in the early part of the 20th century, and we had the first public sector labor law in the country, and you couldn't imagine a better place to take the assault on public sector unions. And from public sector unions, you can go on then to the private sector ones.
Well, but also in between, you've got privatization of education, which he's pushing for. It's already happening in Louisiana, rolling back of women's rights. It's a big package. This is what I find extraordinary, Joel Rogers. Just sort of pulling back to the national perspective is how aggressive the Republicans are about making facts on the ground. Really massive social reengineering going on a national scale. They're starting at the state level, but it's sort of spreading like wildfire. And yet you just feel like on the other side, they're not even in a defensive mode. They seem, they're sort of stunned like somebody that's just got mugged at the ATM.
Well, for all that's a really good point. You remember the Powell memorandum, right?
Yes.
Famous memorandum that Lewis Powell wrote to his friend in the Chamber of Commerce. And in there, as elsewhere, and anyone who's looked at American politics seriously knows that states are where most government happens. And the Republicans post-Powell, the new American right post-Powell, I think really appreciated the importance of building an infrastructure, a political infrastructure in the states, with all the elements that requires, the leadership training, the candidate recruitment and placement, the tending of people when they lose office, the development of a labor pool of competent staffers, the reliable source of money, blah, 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 plus the communication channels, both within their formation and to the mass public, and occasions for them to actually pause and look at strategy. The progressives really never built that in the states at all, in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s or the famous aughts. They started talking about that in the middle of the 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s, but there's been very little real serious effort made on the progressive side of the equation to dominate state politics and to use it as a laboratory of experiment or whatever for a national program on the progressive side to the degree it has been used, as you say, on the conservative or actually radical right side. And Walker is the whole thing. It's not just the unions. It's also the tort reform. It is the privatization. It's a bunch of regressive social law and social issues, or sometimes called social issues, the reproductive rights stuff, and just a huge number of things he's done. So to go back to your first question, though, why do the Kochs think this guy is worth betting on? Because he's a guy worth betting on. He's willing to do that, carry that water.
Well, we saw that in the videotape with that local billionaire, the woman that has the roofing and siding company.
I mean, right.
Literally, he was...
How can
he
we
was
become a red state, a permanent red state?
Right, yeah, he was a supplicant there. But it's almost as though that what we're talking about here, Joel Rogers, is an incremental repeal of the 17th Amendment. It used to be that the state legislatures would pick the U.S. senators because the state legislatures were so corrupt, mm-hmm. And then of course the 17th Amendment brought in direct elections, which I'm not suggesting that's we're going to go back on that, but we've gotten back to the point where state legislatures are for sale.
Well, yeah, they certainly are.
Again, I'm speaking with Joel Rogers, who is a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs COWS, the Center for Wisconsin Strategy. Joel Rogers has written widely on American politics and public policy in such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. So, what's your sense then of where things stand today in terms of, I've been told that if there's a sufficient turnout, this may not go as predicted, and that is be a narrow victory for Scott Walker, but in fact be a victory for Mayor Tom Barron.
Well, there's turnout on both sides, and I think the Republican turnout today has been huge, absolutely huge. As well as, I think it's a very, very high turnout thing. That's all that I've been hearing all day from everyone. Mm-hmm. Talked to a lot of people at different polling places, and they say, I've never seen this many people. But that's as true at, South Bradley, tech school in Milwaukee, in the south side of Milwaukee, heavy Latino district. But it's also true in Waukesha, the most Republican county, more or less, in America. So everyone is mobilized, and the exit polls thus far, and I'm not privy to any fancy stuff here, Ryan, but the exit polls show it's still 50-50 on approval, disapproval of Walker. Maybe 40% saying he was unfair to the unions, 40% saying he wasn't, so sort of equally split there. I'm a little bit worried that it seems to be more than a soft majority. People think that recall is okay, but only when there are actual acts of malfeasance. Although, as you know, Walker is recently named as a subject of interest by the DA. But we don't know, what he's done yet. So I think it's going to be, as described. I've got really nothing intelligent to say to you.
Right.
Turnout all over the place.
We're an hour before the polls close, and going to be tight, it'll take several hours after that, probably. So right. There's no breaking news, but just in closing, though, Joel Rogers, it seems like it's the opposite to what happened here in California when we had a recall that eventually brought in Arnold Schwarzenegger. Gray Davis, the incumbent, tried to make that argument that this was not about him, but about an undemocratic process, and it fell on deaf ears. But I take it may not be the same in Wisconsin.
No, it doesn't feel that way at all. But Barrett has done, I think, a pretty good campaign. It's not as if he had any program to offer, but he was vigorous in attacking outside money and accurate in stating the effect that Walker's had on the state. But Walker's a good politician. He's right on message. He's got a plan. You may find it repellent, but I think a lot of people are attracted to that.
Well, I thank you so much for.
He remains, 45 minutes out. I think he certainly remains the upper dog on this one.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Joel Rogers.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Joel Rogers, who's a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs COWS, the Center for Wisconsin Strategy. He's written widely on American politics and public policy with such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. Joining us now is J.R. Ross, who has spent the last decade covering Wisconsin politics. For the past 4 years, he's been the editor of WisPolitics.com, the state's premier political news service. Prior to that, he spent a decade with the Associated Press, including 6 years as the Wisconsin State House correspondent. Welcome to Background Briefing, J.R. Ross.
How are you doing this evening?
Very well, thanks. And tell me how you're doing in a state that's very much in the national spotlight.
I think this is our 8th election in like 14 or 16 months, something like that. So I think we're all ready for it to be done at this point, get back to a normal summer.
But in terms of the turnout, our previous guest was saying that it's big on both sides. So there's nothing here to alter the predictions to your mind in terms of a narrow victory for Governor Walker?
Well, it's tough to say because we're getting all these anecdotal reports about turnout. You're not seeing countywide numbers yet or things coming in. I mean, it's not just about Milwaukee and Dane counties for Democrats and Ozaukee, Washington, and Waukesha counties for Republicans. There are places like Western Wisconsin that even if, Scott Walker does better in Waukesha County than he did 2 years ago and Tom Barrett is better in Dane County than 2 years ago, that they'll still they have a huge impact because it's a sizable part of the state. So it's kind of hard to say that who's benefiting from turnout right now because we're still an hour from the polls closing. We haven't seen any numbers yet coming from these counties.
Again, I'm speaking with J.R. Ross, who has spent the last decade covering Wisconsin politics. For the past 4 years, he's been the editor of WisPolitics.com, the state's premier political news service. Prior to that, he spent a decade with the Associated Press, including 6 years as the Wisconsin State House correspondent. So what do you think, though, in terms of the dynamics that are driving both sides? What is driving the support for Scott Walker? We're talking about how the advertising has tried to focus to some extent on the recall itself being the problem as opposed to Scott Walker.
There was one ad from an outside group that featured a series of people saying, basically they don't like recalls. And, you know, that was fairly effective. Yeah, there's kind of a sentiment among people I talk to that there's maybe 1, 2, 3 percentage points of the population that may not like Scott Walker, that don't like recalls, that they will either not turn out to vote today, even though they would normally vote against Walker, or two, that they'll turn out and vote for him because they so dislike the recall process. So that's an added hill for Tom Barrett to climb. Yeah, so it's kind of a fluid situation out there right now. But from some of the exit polling we're seeing so far, you know, Walker's got supporters who are basically all geeked up about him. I mean, these people love Scott Walker. They're there for Scott Walker. On the other side, for Tom Barrett, they're not nearly there. They're not completely there just for him as much as they are against Scott Walker. So there's a bit of an enthusiasm gap or between the two sides right now. And then independents are a huge kind of question mark. Can Democrats rebound from how they did in 2010 with those guys and do better tonight?
But do you get any sense that this is that, for example, the debates at which I believe Mayor Barrett did well will have any influence, or is this really being determined by a barrage of television advertising? If so, of course, preponderance of that has been on Walker's side, right? He's outraised. Some statistics have said that he's outraised him 7.5-1.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the debates, the first debate was held on the Friday night of Memorial Day weekend, which is not a good TV viewing time, if you will. The second one was on Thursday night at 9 p.m. Again, not a good time for catching everybody. Now, from what we've seen, they had pretty good ratings for that second debate. But, you know, Governor Walker was smart. He wanted to do debates when people weren't really going to be watching, and he picked two good times to do that. The perception of people I talked to that in those debates, Walker had no real gaffe or, you know, issue where he looked bad. You know, Barrett tried to be more aggressive than what we're used to seeing out of Tom Barrett. He's got a persona as being, you know, kind of a nice guy type thing. He's more on the attack. But there is no real moment in there that you're going to see in a TV ad. And any more debates sometimes, that's what they're all about. It's not really what's said during the debate or you know, what punch is thrown and vice versa. It's what moment lives on in the coverage and the TV ads afterward. And there's no real moment in those debates that lived on. Barrett did chide the governor for an ad he's doing about the crime in Milwaukee that featured a child who later died from an abuse case. And you know, Tom Barrett said, shame on you, Scott Walker, for that. But again, I really have a whole lot of legs after the debate on Thursday.
And what about the other people in the recall, the lieutenant governor and, what, three Republican senators? Is there any sense of where that's going to go?
There are actually four seats that are up in the state Senate. Three of them have incumbents. One, the incumbent resigned to spend more time with their family, so that's an open seat that's being contested as well. The basic, you know, kind of feeling people I talk to is that top of ticket will go a long way determining what happens down below. So if Scott Walker wins, he'll probably pull Rebecca Clayfish across the finish line with him. I mean, she's not well known. You know, Walker is the person people know. If Walker does hit certain, you know, marks in places like Racine and Eau Claire, he'll help a great deal with Terry Moulton and Van Wangard getting across the finish line, because those districts aren't necessarily Republican strongholds. So they need Walker to do well. They're going to help those guys across the finish line.
So just in closing, J.R. Ross, this race has taken on national significance. So one way or the other, do you think that the rest of the nation, and particularly the punditry, it will be correct in reading either that this is if Walker is not recalled, that this is an endorsement of his public employee union strategy and privatization strategy and all of the stuff that the Republicans and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, have put together and they're actively pursuing in various state legislatures? Or will it be seen as a victory for the outspent Labor and Democrats and grassroots activism?
I think that we in the political coverage business sometimes overinterpret things or trying to make a bigger deal than what they are. There are some unique factors happening here in Wisconsin that are influencing this race that people will try to extrapolate out of what happens today for national implications, and there will be some. You know, there will be a message that comes out of this because people talk about there being a message, but you know, Scott Walker winning does not mean the death knell for collective bargaining powers for public employees across the country, and neither does a Tom Barrett win mean that those powers will stay on forever. There will be hits and misses across the country that will vary according to the state, and you know, this is not the end-all, be-all for collective bargaining right here tonight. But you know, there will be a lot of spin coming out of it, at least the next couple of months.
Well, at least there's a sufficient spin that's likely to follow it that's deterred President Obama from putting his foot in the water in this one, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, for the president, there are a number of Democrats who are disappointed he didn't come here. There's probably not a lot of upside for him in some ways. If he did come and, you know, Barrett loses, it all becomes, oh, the president's in trouble in Wisconsin. If he came this past week and Barrett won, people would probably say, well, why weren't you here earlier kind of thing. So, I mean, there's a lot more downside than upside for him. And the reality is that, you know, looking ahead to November, there is one train of thought that I hear from people that whatever happens today, if Walker wins, that there'll be a big boost for Republicans, that it puts Wisconsin in play with Mitt Romney. Because the theory being that, look, you know, we had these elections last spring where the Supreme Court race for a seat in the state Supreme Court became a referendum on collective bargaining. The conservative candidate won that. There were recall elections last summer for state Senate seats, and Republicans held the majority of state Senate once that was all said and done. If Republicans hold today, then that would be the third time in a row that progressives have been asked in Wisconsin to kind of answer that bell and turn out, and they came up short each time. The theory being, well, okay, they came up short those three times, they won't be excited come November for Obama, and it makes the state easier for Republicans to win. The other side that I hear is that, look, this is probably a different universe of voters that will come out on Election Day, November, than compared to today. I mean, we don't know for sure what turnout's going to be like. We're hearing near presidential level, so that might not be that big of a difference. But college kids are all gone for the summer. They've gone home, gone out of state. So their college campuses aren't being organized to turn out to vote like you would be in November. Number two, Tammy Baldwin's running for the U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. She is the only candidate on the Democratic side, so she will have the party's nomination. She's vying to become the first openly gay woman in the U.S. Senate. She's a movement-type candidate that will excite the progressive base in Wisconsin. And even if they're not excited about President Obama or they feel oppressed about what's happened the last three times out, she'll excite them. So that's the other train of thought. So, I mean, it could have an impact. It's not going to make it any easier for President Obama no matter what happens. You know, tomorrow there's been a ton of money spent in Wisconsin in these races. There's a question how much money is going to be left for Wisconsin, what resources will come in here after what happens. So, you know, it doesn't make his life any easier, but it might not make it impossible come November.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, J.R. Ross.
Anytime. Take care.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with J.R. Ross, who spent the last decade covering Wisconsin politics. For the past 4 years, he has been the editor of WisPolitics.com, the state's premier political news service. Prior to that, he spent a decade with the Associated Press, including 6 years as the Wisconsin State House correspondent. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the record amount of out-of-state money pouring into Wisconsin.
There's power in a factory, power in the land. Power in the hand of the worker, but it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The strikes of the bosses we must fight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Leaders, a veteran Wisconsin newspaper editor and reporter. He is the Money and Politics Project Director at WisconsinWatch.org. Previously, he spent 25 years as a news editor of the Isthmus, Madison's popular weekly paper. Elected president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group devoted to protecting public access to meetings and records. He has written several books, the latest of which is Watchdog, 25 Years of Muckraping and Rabble-Rousing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Leaders.
Good to be here.
And you're at the Wisconsin Capitol as we speak, and this, of course, has been a very, very big day in Wisconsin. Is there any sense that the turnout today was equivalent or close to equivalent of what happened in 2008?
Yes, the indications are that turnout is extraordinarily high, much higher than we would normally see for a gubernatorial race, and very close to the level that we would see for a presidential race, like 2008 when Barack Obama was elected. Wisconsin has about 6 million people and about 3 million eligible voters went to the polls in 2008. It looks like we're going to come very close to that in this recall election, the $3 million total, or 3 million voter total.
So does that mean then, is that good news for the challenger and the bad news for the incumbent, Governor Scott Walker?
Well, you like to know. They certainly would like to know. Everyone has said all along that this comes down to turnout, and both sides have told their supporters that the outcome will hinge on turnout. Apparently that message got through to people who felt one way or the other about this election, and people are turning out. How the election will turn out, you know, that's, I hate to use the cliche, but it does remain to be seen.
So, Bill Leaders, how effective has this campaign on television? First of all, my understanding is that Walker has outspent his opponent, Mayor Tom Barrett, by 7.5 to 1, and a lot of that money's gone into television. And my understanding is that the television campaign that they've been running is basically not about the recall issue, but it's basically making the argument that the recall process itself is wrong and it's undemocratic, and we should return Governor Scott Walker, not based on the merits, but on the fact that the recall is an undemocratic process.
Yeah, that is one of the themes that is being sounded in the pro-Walker advertising, that not letting him finish his term is undemocratic, that, you know, just because some people got their nose in a snit over some things he did, we shouldn't have an election midterm. They're also running a great deal of advertising, which just dumps on Tom Barrett and suggests that Milwaukee is a stinking cesspool of contagion, and that, you know, God forbid this man should come to power in the state capitol because of the terrible mess he's made in Milwaukee. That's another big theme of the pro-Walker advertising. What's extraordinary about the advertising, though, I think, isn't the messaging so much as the volume. We've never seen anything like this in the state of Wisconsin. We're talking basically $40 million of spending by the candidates themselves, with $32 million of that money coming from the Scott Walker side. Tom Barrett has raised $4.5 million as of this morning. They're putting much of this into commercials. Plus, there's independent expenditures by outside groups seeking to influence the election. I just looked at a tally that put independent expenditures through today at $27 million in addition to what the candidates are spending. And then there's a whole third category of campaign spending, which is the issue ad spending. This is the ads that don't tell you exactly who you should vote for or vote against, but convey a message that's trying to sway your opinion about the candidate. Those groups do not report in Wisconsin. They don't say how much they raise. They don't say how much they spend. And their expenditures are not included in any of these running tallies.
So my understanding, it's got up to about, what, $63.5 million? Would that
be? That's what they tabulated last week. My sense is that it's probably closer to $70 million now, just in terms of no one spending by the people who have to declare that they're, you know, raising money and spending money on the election. And probably there's at least $10 million and maybe as much as $25 million additional that's being spent in these issue ads that, you know, have not been factored in yet. After the election, when the groups have the time to go to the television stations around the state and review their books and look at the political ad buys that were made, they're going to put a number to that issue ad expenditure, at least for what came out in terms of radio and television ads. But we won't know pre-election just how much money is being pumped into the process by these third-party issue ad groups.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Leaders, a veteran Wisconsin newspaper editor and reporter. He is the Money and Politics Project Director at WisconsinWatch.org, and previously he spent 25 years as the news editor of the Isthmus, Madison's popular weekly paper. How do Wisconsinites, or what do you call them, badgers, is that right? Or that's the badger state?
Badgers or cheeseheads or...
Okay. How do the badgers slash cheeseheads feel about all this money pouring in from out of state?
Well, I think everyone has a certain level of disgust or at least aversion to the volume of campaign spending that we're seeing. I mean, Governor Walker made a joke about how the citizens of the state are eager to get their television back, you know, to be able to watch television without being bombarded with ads. You know, when he voted this morning, he made that remark. And I think there is a sense that what we're seeing is extraordinary, that it is overkill, that it is too much. But, you know, how you vote depends on how you feel about the candidates who are running. And I don't know that anyone is going to vote or not vote based on their feeling that there's too much messaging. They're going to vote or not vote based on their feeling about the candidates and the issues.
Well, but how do they know about the candidates and the issues? The system is so controlled by television and by television advertising. Mm-hmm. They only had, a couple of debates. Tell me, how would you consider those debates affecting this election as opposed to the $70 million worth of media buys?
Well, I think there are a number of things that are factoring into people's vote. One is just their reaction to what has happened in Wisconsin in the last year and a half. A lot of people were very emotionally involved in these events on one side or another. We had 100,000 people converge one day in our state capitol. We had crowds of more than 10,000 people converge for, you know, day after day for weeks at a time. It was extraordinary, and it was galvanizing, and for some people, it was a life-changing experience. And there are other people who really love and admire our Governor Scott Walker. And I don't use the term love lightly, like, you know, in The Simpsons, they said once, "I love you like I love Fresca." No, uh-uh. These people love Scott Walker like they love their mother. They believe that he is an extraordinarily good and courageous politician, and they will follow him into battle. And that's certainly what we have here is a battle.
But there is an asymmetry, surely, Bill Leaders, between a spontaneous demonstration of hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites and a few out-of-state billionaires pouring money in to have this guy reelected. Is that lost on the people who love this guy?
Well, you know, there is a significant amount of money coming into Wisconsin from people in other states who recognize this election as being nationally significant. I said before that Scott Walker has raised $32 million in contributions to his campaign. Of that, 59%, as of last tally, came from people who live in other states. For Tom Barrack, he's raised $4.5 million. Of that, 26%, a little more than a quarter, came from people in other states. Even that 26%, it's extraordinary. You know, in the Wisconsin election, if you had 5% of the receipts coming from people who don't even live in the state, that would be extraordinary in the past. What we're seeing is just a tremendous amount of national interest, a tremendous amount of spending, and it's not just billionaires in other states who are bankrolling Walker. He does receive contributions from, you know, conservatives all across the country who are giving smaller amounts, and he does receive, you know, 41% at least of his contributions from people in Wisconsin who also like and support his agenda.
So, Bill Leaders, there's been, of course, on the progressive side, there have been a lot of complaints that the Democratic Party has not been ponying up any money and that President Obama himself has been AWOL. Do you think if the president had inserted himself in this, would it have worked in any way? Or what's the local feeling about the Democratic Party not helping Barrett as much as clearly the Republican Party has been helping Scott Walker? The head of the Republican Party has been in Wisconsin, Reince Priebus.
Yes, well, and there have been prominent Democrats who have come to Wisconsin to support Tom Barrett. Bill Clinton was here last week and made a couple of appearances. I do know the Democrats, some Democrats, are a little sore at Obama for not doing more to back Barrett's candidacy. I guess he sent a tweet last night saying that he was supporting Tom Barrett, and, you know, people feel that maybe it should have been more for him. Would it have made a difference? I don't know. the people who really like Walker really don't like Obama to some extent, but this isn't about Obama. This isn't about national politics. I don't even think it's much of an indicator of how things will swing in the presidential election. This is very much about what has happened here in Wisconsin with the governor coming into power, making very serious fundamental changes in terms of the state's covenant with its public employees, which they perceived as a betrayal and as an insult, and for which they are trying to, you know, they're trying to respond to that by removing him from office. That is the fundamental issue here. And who stands on the sidelines and shouts from among the political elite on either side, I don't really think that's going to make that much of a difference.
Well, Bill Leaders, you may well be right, but it won't make any difference in terms of how the mainstream press deals with it, whether you like it or not. I could almost guarantee you that this story will be treated as a national referendum. If the Republicans win, it'll put the wind in their sails. And if the Democrats win, it'll be a huge sigh of relief for them.
Yeah, but I'm speaking exclusively about what impact it will have on the presidential election later this year. I don't know about that. Certainly, if the Republicans win, it's going to fill the sails of all of the Republican governors across the nation who have been thinking about making dramatic changes in terms of their state's covenant with their public employees, have been looking about taking a tough tack to unions. It's going to green light a lot of that type of thing, and it's going to like affirm that that can be an approach that you can do and you can survive and you can win. And, you know, there's no doubt it will have national political implications in terms of how governors act in other states. As far as the presidential race, though, will it matter in terms of Romney v. Obama? I think that's much more iffy.
Well, Bill Leaders, I thank you so much for joining us here. I appreciate your time on this very busy day for you.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Leaders, who's a veteran Wisconsin newspaper editor and reporter. He is the Money and Politics Project Director at WisconsinWatch.org, and previously he spent 25 years as a news editor of The Isthmus, Madison's popular weekly paper. Elected president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group devoted to protecting public access to meetings and records, he has written several books, the latest of which is Watchdog, 25 Years of Muckraking and Rabble-Rousing. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a labor reporter who was locked in a room in the Capitol by the communications director of the Honeywell Corporation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Elk, who is a labor journalist based in Washington, D.C. He writes for Harper's Magazine, The American Prospect, The Huffington Post, and is a staff writer for In These Times. Last Thursday, he attempted to question Honeywell CEO David Cote at an event at the U.S. Capitol, but the microphone was ripped from his hand. Since then, the video of this incident has gotten 50,000 views on YouTube. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Elk.
Thanks. Great to be on the show.
And just set the scene for us there. Was this a committee room hearing, or where did this take place, this incident? In the corridors, or just describe the environment first.
This hearing happened. It was a public forum held with a bunch of CEOs and congressmen talking about the economy. And I got up to ask a question at this forum. And I started asking it, and immediately somebody was beckoning at me to take to stop asking a question, and they tried to take the microphone away from me, and I resisted them taking the microphone away from me. And then finally, they pulled the microphone out of my hands. This is a senior advisor to Congressman Tim Scott. Pulled the microphone out of my hands, and they started questioning me, and somebody pulled my arm, the staffer for the congressman, and tried to pull me out of the room.
So did you say this was a public hearing?
Yes, this is a public hearing. It was a public event, open to the public, and I got credentialed as a reporter, and I was called upon to ask a question, and I stood up and asked it, and, this isn't a public building. It's in the basement of the U.S. Capitol.
And the fact that they didn't like the question was sufficient to have the staffer for Representative Tim Scott. Was he the chair of this subcommittee?
It wasn't a subcommittee. It was just an event he was hosting.
Oh, so it wasn't a hearing then. It was what kind of an event was it? A fundraiser or a...
No, it was just an event on manufacturing in the U.S.
Oh, I see,
And whatnot, yes.
And was there any other CEOs apart from the Honeywell CEO there?
Yeah, Carly Fiorina,
Fiorina, yeah.
Yeah, was there. As was Steve Forbes. I mean, there were a lot of folks there.
I see. So
a lot of Republican congressmen and lobbyists running around.
Okay, and were there any other reporters present?
Yes, there were several other reporters present, some of whom recorded it, some colleagues of mine.
Uh-huh.
There was another reporter present. I showed up to the event, and I gave them my business card, and they gave me a lanyard that identified me with a badge on it that identified me as a member of the press.
Uh-huh.
And I then took that that lanyard, wore it over my neck and had it in there. And as I was being, this guy was trying to haul me out of the room for asking this question, I said to him, I'm a member of the press, I don't want to be treated this way. And this woman, who I guess was also a member of the press, I don't know who she was, screamed, where's your credentials? And I said, they're here. And she said, that's not Hill credentials, because if you're a member of the press on the Hill, if you work there regularly, you need special credentials. Which I don't work in the Capitol Hill regularly.
So who was this woman then? Was she with the Capitol Hill press corps? Did she have the credentials?
Yeah, she had the certain credentials. But the fact is, I identified myself as a member of the press, and I gave them my business card when I showed in. So they knew who I was.
Right.
And
it's a public hearing, so I don't.
Yeah.
But who was this woman, by the way? That
I don't know her name. I don't know her.
You don't know what affiliation she was? What?
No, I have no idea.
Well, that seems extraordinary that a fellow journalist would want to hang you out to dry when clearly you're in the right, in as much as you're an American citizen. I take it, and you're entitled to be there. Again, I'm speaking with Mike Elk, who is a labor journalist based in Washington, D.C. He writes for Harper's Magazine, The American Prospect, The Huffington Post, and is a staff writer for In These Times. Last Thursday, he attempted to question Honeywell CEO David Coate at an event at the U.S. Capitol, but the microphone was ripped from his hand. Since then, the video of this incident has gotten 50,000 views on YouTube. What was it about the question that had this the aide from Tim Scott? Now, Tim Scott's he's a Republican, right? From where? From Tennessee or somewhere?
South Carolina.
South Carolina, right? So tell me. What the question was that upset these people on Capitol Hill?
The question that upset these kind of people is that I was asking about a labor struggle where a bunch of union workers were replaced with non-union workers in violation of a contract at a uranium facility in southern Illinois, and one of these non-union workers caused a release of toxic radioactive UF6 gas into the atmosphere for 7 minutes. And I was asking about that. And I was asking about, problems with the fact that they didn't notify the community about the leak and that they didn't do all these other things. So I was asking about this when this situation happened here. And they wanted to cut me off. And the incredible part was Congressman Tim Scott then came up to me and said, well, you can talk to, the CEO afterwards. There's going to be a little huddle and you can go and try to talk to him. And I said, all right. So I went to go... and try to talk to the CEO, and immediately he ran into a side room. I followed him into that side room, and when I got in there, I got shoved by a member of his staff, as well as another member who I identified as Rob Ferris, Honeywell's external communications director. And Cody then ran out of separate doors, and Rob Ferris, who works for Honeywell, then barricaded me into this room and wouldn't let me leave it for several minutes, which is illegal. It's false imprisonment. And today I filed charges against both the GOP staffer for grabbing me, a simple assault, and as well as false imprisonment against Honeywell's external communications director, Rob Ferris.
So tell me, I mean, false imprisonment, you could almost stretch that to kidnapping, technically, but you were literally held in a kind of ante-room in the Capitol and forcibly held by...
Not by the police, but by Honeywell aides.
Yeah, aides to this guy, David Cote, or Cote, is that how you pronounce it?
Cody.
So where were the Capitol police in this? Were they around anyway to...
No, they weren't around when any of this happened. And then afterwards, I left the room and I followed the gentleman that held me in the hallway demanding that they give me their identification. And I still don't know who the one gentleman was. And they refused to do this. They refused to give me their identification. And I was swearing at them. I was upset. I'd been held against my will. And the Capitol Police, I guess they had the Capitol Police detain me briefly for questioning. And they asked me if I wanted to file charges. And at first I said no, because, you know, as a reporter, you don't want to sound like a crybaby. You want to sound like you can take your punches. And then I decided that I did want to file charges because, you know, this is a public building. If public figures want to come into a public building, then anybody who has the right to come and question them. The U.S. Capitol, the Congress may be financially owned by Honeywell, but the U.S. Capitol is still publicly owned property. And if they want to come onto it, they're going to be asked tough questions.
So it sounds like the Capitol Police actually were on your side in as much as they...
Yeah, and they've been very supportive when I've talked with them. I waited over the weekend because I just needed to think it over. And they said to me, you know, we're going to, you know, we want to do something. I said to them, I want to do something, so...
Well, you know, again, I'm speaking with Mike Elk, a labor journalist based in Washington, D.C. He writes for Harper's Magazine, The American Prospect, The Huffington Post, and is a staff writer for In These Times. And last Thursday, he attempted to question Honeywell CEO David Cote at an event at the U.S. Capitol, but the microphone was ripped from his hand. And since then, the video has gone viral and gotten 50,000 views on YouTube. You know, this is similar to what happened fairly recently to Joel Fox, who made the film Gasland, and he's finishing up a sequel to his film Gasland that was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And he was attempting to film a public hearing on Capitol Hill recently involving oil and gas issues, you know, pertinent to his film, and in particularly representatives of the Environmental Protection Agency were being grilled by oil-friendly Republican congressmen about EPA's findings that water in, I think, Montana and Wyoming had been contaminated by fracking and it had gotten into the underground aquifers. And this was testimony from that the congresspeople were trying to refute that the EPA scientists had were on the hot seat having to defend. And he got kicked out of the hearing. I don't know that a lot of solidarity was there from the rest of the press, although it was filmed. Apart from the fact that as an American citizen and a reporter, you're being shut down, the thing that I find appalling is that your colleagues in the press don't come to your defense.
Well, you know, the next day, President Obama was on stage with the same CEO of Honeywell, and ABC News interviewed him and didn't even ask anything about the incident. It's well known that a lot of these kind of people have an agreement with reporters. I'll talk to you, but only if you don't ask me tough questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the spirit in Washington. You don't want to upset your sources. You know, I used to think the problem with the media was that it was corporately owned. And having worked as a reporter for several years, I think the bigger problem is that people are afraid of taking on their sources. They're lazy. They don't have courage. I think that's the bigger problem.
Well, they don't want to lose access, right? And if they lose access, then their editors can say, well, we don't need you, you know. Yeah. That's the way that, I guess, the system, that's how they're co-opted, right?
Yeah.
So what's the next move then? You're going to sue?
I filed charges against them.
against both the
other legal options, including a civil suit. I'm looking for lawyers on that.
Right, but you, specifically, you're going to, you're filing charges against the aide to Representative Tim Scott. He's the one who physically tried to wrest the microphone away from you.
Yeah, and that's simple assault.
Right.
And I'm filing charges against Rob Ferris, who's the Honeywell corporate communications director.
And he's the guy that locked you in a room, an anteroom in the Capitol, to prevent you from talking to his boss, the CEO of Honeywell, David Cote.
Yeah.
Well, what can I say? It's an appalling example of the power of the oligarchy versus the fecklessness of the press. I mean, where the press is supposed to be the watchdogs, not the lapdogs. And if you get roughed up and held against your will by the flax for the oligarchs, that's a pretty sad day. You're saying that ABC the next day had an opportunity to bring it up. Did they know about the incident?
I don't know if they know about the incident, but the bigger question is, why doesn't every reporter in the country know about different labor struggles that are happening? I've been writing about Honeywell for 2 years, and this is the most attention I've ever gotten.
Right, and then...
I've been writing about three different labor struggles. I mean, they're on a union-busting power drive, and Obama is very close with the CEO of Honeywell. Indeed, while there was a lockout at this uranium facility in Metropolis, Illinois, the President Obama flew on Air Force One with Honeywell CEO Dave Cote.
So what's the explanation? I mean, I don't imagine it's because of his relation with Obama that the press don't cover it. It seems to be a broader issue that they don't cover labor issues because the corporate press is owned by corporations who have their own problems with labor. At least they don't have they have an adversarial relationship. Would that be the explanation?
Yeah.
I see. So that,
yeah, I mean, I think the big problem in this situation is that these guys, I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about Fortune Magazine. They did this big profile for the Honeywell CEO. And in Fortune Magazine, what they basically said was, you know, he was able to keep the company profitable because he kept labor costs down while productivity went up. Well, what does that mean to keep labor costs down? This guy wrote a 4,000-word article, didn't interview a single Honeywell worker. That's the problem with the press, is that they think it's this conversation between the elites and not a conversation that actually involves regular folks and elites.
Well, but the story that you specifically asked the CEO of Honeywell about is that in a labor dispute, they brought in non-union labor who clearly doesn't have the training. The guy turned on some valve that released radioactivity into the environment. That's not a labor issue. That's an environmental issue. That affects everybody.
Yeah, I certainly agree.
So,
and I think it's a big issue, and I think it's something that I think, you know, it's just awful. I mean, there's so few labor reporters in this country. I feel like I know all six of them. It's awful.
Well, you know, you're talking to a member of the non-corporate press, so I mean, I sympathize with you, and I wish that the Pacifica Network was more powerful instead of, you know, being on the verge of bankruptcy. I don't know what to tell you, you know, except that, you know, me and my listeners are in great sympathy with you, and yeah. We're very concerned that the playing field in this country is so far from level with following Citizens United. I mean, the cynicism of Citizens United is that the Supreme Court allows both corporations and unions to put unlimited amounts of money into campaigns, but
not just that, but now workers under Citizens United have to go to captive audience political readings. It gave corporations the right to do that, to hold, you know, to sit down and have a meeting with your boss and talk about who you're going to vote to. I mean, we covered how the Kochs were already doing that at Georgia Pacific.
So you mean, as a part of Citizens United, corporate CEOs can force their employees to be influenced by corporate and pro-Republican propaganda?
Yeah. We wrote a big story on it, Thought Control at Coke, last year for The Nation, where we went out to the Georgia Pacific plants in Oregon, and the Koch brothers were making their workers attend libertarian seminars and sending them letters in the mail about how their jobs would be at risk if they didn't vote Republican. That used to be illegal before Citizens United. I think that's more threatening in some way than all the money coming in.
Well, the point I was trying to make there, Mike Lux, is that the playing field is not level between the treasuries of unions and the treasuries of corporations. It's just ridiculous, and that unions are only down to about 6% of the workforce, and the public sector unions are under a threat from all these Republican governors who are trying to shut them down. And of course, you know, as we speak, there's a recall in Wisconsin, about that very issue.
Yep.
Well, just give us a closing sense of, you know, I don't want to feel defeated here. I want to feel that there's a way for the American people to take back their government and the American worker to get more justice and better benefits. Could even in a small way be commensurate with the working conditions in other Western democracies?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you got to do what folks are doing in Wisconsin. They're trying. You know, the national unions didn't want to do that recall. I think folks got to get together and organize, and I think they can make some progress. Look, I don't see any big policy solutions being proposed in Washington that will help workers at all. The only ones I see being done are what workers at Palmero Pizza did in Milwaukee yesterday, where they went out on strike. I think that's how folks are going to get stuff, is not to look to their leaders, but to look to themselves and to get away from all this false rhetoric that TV news has. I mean, it's really about organizing the workplace.
Well, Mike Elkei, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great to be on.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Elkei, who's a labor journalist based in Washington, D.C. He writes for Harper's Magazine, The American Prospect, The Huffington Post, and is a staff writer for In These Times. And last Thursday, he attempted to question Honeywell CEO David Cote at an event at the U.S. Capitol, but the microphone was ripped from his hand. Since then, the video has gone viral with 50,000 views on YouTube. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.